Blog Talk Radio.
All right, good evening to our listeners and to our guest tonight, Meredith Moran, here on Men Matter. Meredith.
Hi.
Let me do the briefest of introductions here. Your resume is so complete we could spend tonight's hour on what you've done in the past, literary and journalist time, and come back next week to discuss, so I'll try and cut it down. Meredith is a journalist and writer, and actually from the age of six, I understand, reading from what, even throughout my life, has been one of my favorites, Highlights for Kids.
Right.
Bringing back memories of the dentist's office. She's written 8 books, yes.
That's not right.
Very many
yeah.
of them. San Francisco Chronicle bestsellers. One that I've actually asked, Dirty, which I thought was a fascinating book.
Thanks.
But also a number of other excellent works, and more in the line of storytelling, and very good at putting the reader in the moment, and probably among the authors that I've read, certainly well respected by me and certainly others, as being able to bring a topic right to the fore as if you're there. So welcome, and
I
appreciate your time tonight.
I'm glad it's been realized. Thank you.
Well, it worked for me, as they say. In preparing for the show, you have so many copious interviews and articles. Let me say, I read the book. I have a personal interest in this, given a circumstance, father, and I guess my initial question would be, how, as a journalist, with your objectivity, with a trained eye and a trained mind in the objective end of things, how did you find yourself swept, as you say, into the feminist movement, recovered memory, sort of, somewhere along the line I read a perfect storm of all of these factors coming together to move you towards making an accusation, albeit in the height of the accusing 80s, 90s,
Well, that is sort of the central question of the book, and I assume when you refer to the book that your listeners know what the book is. Is that true?
Yes, we're referring here to My Lie, A True Story of False Memory.
Okay, and it took me 300 pages to answer the question that you just asked me, because that's the whole focus of the book. Is the central question of the book really is, how did I and how did so many thousands of other intelligent people come to believe the same lie at the same time? And I guess the shorthand answer for me, obviously I can only answer for myself, although in the book and for the book I interviewed some other people who were in a similar situation. For me it was, as you say, a perfect storm of the personal and the political, or the cultural and the psychological. And to be more specific, the country was caught up in this, not just our country, but many Western countries were caught up in this notion that any man could be a pedophile or a sexual predator, and that there were unknown thousands or millions of adult women walking around with forgotten memories of childhood sexual abuse. And so there was this external pressure or external reality that was, that was set up, as you say, during the late 80s and early 90s. And then that combined with a unique family profile everyone had. I mean, I had my own, but every woman or man or child who made this accusation had a unique set of circumstances. And in my case, my family seemed, when I started to investigate it with the suspicion that I had been abused as a child, my family seemed to have the perfect incestuous profile, and so that, you know, the personal circumstances also worked in favor of the lie.
You did an interview a while back, I forget where I made that from a note, someone asked what you most wanted to be asked about the book, and from my notes I wrote, the connection between the brainwashing of Meredith Moran and the brainwashing of the American public.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of your what you said just a moment ago kind of plays into that. But the concept of brainwashing mm-hmm. comes to the fore on that. Do you think that it was brainwashing in the sense that we all think about it, just the constant reworking of a thought process, turn it from one direction towards another?
Well, you know, I did a lot of research when I was writing the book. I wanted to know the actual definitions of brainwashing, the actual definition of mass hysteria, which is another phrase that's been used to describe this time. And technically, this episode in our history doesn't really qualify for either one of those phenomena, which have very specific sort of scientific symptoms and so on. But I think what's most important for us to really pay attention to is the fact that when a large number of people come to believe the same lie at the same time, that it can be widely perceived as true. And you know, I quote from Hitler in the beginning of the book, saying, you know, just, I can't remember the exact words now, but, you know, tell a lie, tell it over and over, and pretty soon everyone thinks it's true. And so right now on our political scene, I certainly see plenty of evidence of this. As I mentioned in the book, you know, having been writing the book during the 2008 presidential campaign and watching, I'm sure, in many cases, very well-intentioned, otherwise intelligent people swearing that Obama was not born in this country, was a Muslim. Just yesterday on TV, I saw an interview in which,
right.
Who was that? Was it Sean Hannity or someone
It was Hannity, I think, yes.
It was Hannity, yeah, in a group of people saying, how many of you believe that Obama's religious affiliation makes him, you know, is affecting his decisions about foreign policy? And all these people in the audience said, well, yeah, he's a Muslim, so of course he's making decisions as a Muslim. It's just, you know, it's pretty incredible that, you know, it takes a long time to publish a book. And when I was writing the book, I was thinking, God, by the time this book comes out, no one will believe that anyone ever thought Obama wasn't born in this country or that he was a Muslim. And now here it is years later, and we're still at it.
Right, and some of the small things I read somewhere that at one point he had his wedding ring and his watch were not on that day. And someone had implied that that was a sign that he was a Muslim because it's not permitted during Ramadan. The smallest of things.
Right. So when you think about the provable factual errors that are made. I mean, either the guy was born one place or he was born somewhere else. You know, there's documentation on that. As opposed to, gee, was I treated badly as a child, or was I maybe even abused? Oh, my God, was I sexually abused? And, you know, each person who was involved in that episode had to ask all these questions herself. There was no Sean Hannity to say, well, yeah, you know, he's a Muslim and that's why he's doing what he's doing in the Middle East or whatever. It was sort of every family for itself.
Right. Left alone, so to speak, without a compass.
Right. I mean, there was, as I said, you know, on the outside, just to give it some context, the reason that I wrote the book was that I had, before I ever thought that I had any personal stake in this story, I had been a journalist and spent about 5 years in the early 80s trying to dispel the myth that incest was a one in a million crime, which was the prevailing belief at that time. And there were lots of feminist researchers, or a handful of feminist researchers, who were doing studies and so on that were proving that that wasn't the case. And they were right, and I was right to write articles that I wrote at that time saying, you know, we need programs for prevention, we need programs for treatment, we can't pretend that this isn't happening just because it's a secret crime. You know, if somebody gets shot on the street, there are witnesses and it can't be denied, but if a girl is raped by her father in her bedroom, that can be kept secret forever. So that's how my involvement in this started. I was very much feeling like a crusader for the truth. And I just want to put that in context, because today our awareness of both the prevalence and the consequences of childhood abuse is much more advanced than it was, 20 or 30 years ago. So that was actually a good thing.
Well, clearly, and I think you've made the point somewhere along the way, or I've gleaned it, that despite comments on how the feminist movement had a sort of momentum to it, it still did a lot of good. There's a lot that came out of the feminist movement, and still does, that is that is valuable and irreversibly good. I mean, I say that's probably the wrong word, but significantly for the better. But the momentum that built up, I think, may have carried some elements within the feminist movement too far.
Well, yeah, including me. And, you know, one thing I think about all the time is the question of shades of gray. And we're not very good at that in this country. And, you know, I think the big surprise of Obama being elected, it was so surprising on so many levels. And, you know, people have a lot of theories about why that is. But I have to say, my theory is that a big part of it was exactly what he's being criticized for now, which is his nonpartisan approach, you know, saying that he wanted to unite people and that nothing was that simple, nobody's right, nobody's wrong, and everybody got mad at him for not, you know, taking enough of a stand against the Republicans or whatever. But that's what we voted for. We voted for a different way of seeing things that didn't see, you know, enemies everywhere and didn't see differences and tried to look for similarities. And so I think that's part of the problem, is that we, you know, the culture sort of went from a position of incest is this fluky thing that never happens, and if it did, we'd know it because the father, the guy who committed the incest, would be wearing a gray trench coat, you know, and hanging around the schoolyard, to thinking every guy could be a child molester, and all these women are walking around with these repressed memories, and then thinking, oh, no, that whole recovered memory thing, that was all made up. None of that is true. And, you know, there are germs of truth in all of those things, but none of them simply is true. And I think if there's one lesson that I learned personally from going through this experience, which was so devastating to my family, it's that any time you think you know everything there is to know about something, and every time you're convinced that you're right and someone else is wrong, and it's that simple, unless that person is saying, you know, the sky is below your feet, even that could be debated.
Right.
But you know what I'm saying? Like, just
yes.
Question everything and allow for the other person's point of view and allow a little light into these big arguments that we're having personally and politically.
In retrospect, you made mention about the process of therapy and how we turn to therapy. We're big on that, have been. Do you feel that therapy itself is a microcosm of sort of that momentum we just described, in that it has become, for some areas and even still some residuals in the abuse industry, I'll call it that because it does seem like that sometimes, has it not stopped the momentum because there are so many hair-splitting diagnoses anymore that we become a, I think it was Sally Satel in One Nation Under Therapy, that we've come to see this as the answer. We don't surround ourselves with family or introspection or I'll call it local assets, friends, family. That we run to therapy as a help me. Therapy is correct.
Yeah.
Is that in your opinion?
I think that's. First of all, I think there's an economic basis to almost everything in this country. And So on the economic level, that has changed for the simple reason that insurance companies are not paying for therapy anymore. They're paying for drugs. And so whether the pharmaceutical companies led the way and then the scientists all said, oh, look, you can take a pill instead of going to therapy for 5 years, or whether it happened the other way around, I really can't tell you. But I do know that therapy has become less popular simply for economic reasons, let alone any philosophical or, you know, critical judgments about therapy itself. But what you're saying I also think is true, which is that we are very much a culture, as we said before, that leaves people to their own devices in a lot of ways. You know, that a lot of people believe in God in one form or another and have a spiritual community of one kind or another, and people get a lot of solace out of that, and yet, you know, if you're having a marital problem, and you know you've got three kids, and you don't want them to lose their family, you know, in most cases, going to church is not going to solve that problem. And in other cultures, they do have other methods of solving emotional, psychological, familial, whatever problems, and we are really sorely lacking in that in this culture.
I agree, and, mm-hmm. and which leads me to my next point. Having been a therapized child, I think it's we were in therapy for quite a few times as a young girl.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a grooming ground for our susceptibility to something later on? Did that groom you to say, others will tell me what I'm thinking or give me a template for how to think? Was it a false, or I shouldn't say that. Do you think that influenced your thinking?
Well,
in,
I think,
the fact
you know,
you're in therapy.
It's kind of chicken and egg. First of all, I want to say clearly for myself that nobody told me that this happened to me. I was not one of the people, and there were people, whose therapists led them down that path. I was not led down that path. In fact, I saw many therapists over the years while I was trying to figure out if my father had molested me, and not one of them ever said, well, what was said to people I knew then, you know, anything like, well, obviously this is what happened to you and obviously this is what's wrong. On the other hand, no one ever said, this clearly did not happen, could not have happened. So I just want to clarify that one of the stereotypes about this whole episode is that every woman who believed she had recovered memories of sexual abuse had discovered those memories in therapy, and that was not true for me. At the same time, I think that the therapy culture, the idea that, as you said, you know, someone knows my truth better than I do, that's bad therapy. And if anybody is going to a therapist, whoever says to them, I know better than you do about anything, the client should leave the therapist immediately, because good therapy means helping you come to your own conclusions. And again, even during these years when therapists were under tremendous pressure to, as one of my ex-therapists says in the book, to go on a fishing expedition looking for incest and recovered memories, the fact is my therapists were very much kind of giving me the lead and not telling me what I was to think or what might have happened to me, although some therapists did do that.
Right. I guess, and maybe you've answered it and I didn't hear. When you were young, as a child, if you can think back to that,
mm-hmm.
not regarding abuse allegations or abuse uh-huh. memories, but just
kind
think
of setting
as a child
up a
that,
mindset, yeah.
Yeah, the I'm going to go to the therapist and they're going to give me the direction.
Yeah, well, it's funny because The reason I was in therapy as a child is that I was a very rebellious child who never wanted to be told what I should think or do, which
we
is
we need
actually,
to fix that.
Yeah, really. And so I didn't ever want to go to therapy. I mean, of course, when I was five and my parents were sending me to the, you know, this was the 50s, so it was very early on in the Mad Men era when people were more likely to have a martini and a Milltown than go to therapy. But, you know, I never wanted to go. And, in fact, when I was a teenager and my parents made me go, actually just about 13, I actually cut a deal with the psychiatrist and said, look, what are they paying you? And I think it was $60 an hour or something. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, you give me 30 and I'll never tell them that I never show up. And he actually made the deal with me. And I used to go make out with my boyfriend for the 50 minutes. He happened to live, was very handy. He happened to live very close to the therapist. And so, you know, I was not a sheep being led into therapy. However, that said, I know what you're getting at. And I think that, you know, the concept that I learned at a very early age, well, you know, my parents feeling disturbed that I was rebellious, and I had a lot of weird physical ailments too, which of course later fed my belief I had been molested. But at the time, my parents were wondering why I was having all these symptoms and just weird, you know, weird manifestations of they didn't know what. So they, you know, what is the solution? Well, we were and are ethnic Jews, but not religious Jews. We had no, they were barely speaking to their parents, you know, no extended family whatsoever, and who were they to turn to? And so that was, in fact, you know, my setup for if something's wrong, that's what you do.
Right. So early on, when you were younger, your relationship with your dad was... Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, very young, it was fairly non-existent. My father still says, I mean, my father now has four grandchildren, and he's the first to admit that they are completely of no interest to him until they can have an intelligent conversation with him. So early on, he wasn't very involved. And it was a very typical 50s kind of father-daughter relationship, i.e. he went out and made the money and, you know, mom changed the diapers. But later on, once I could talk and have an interesting conversation with him, we became very close, and in a way that, you know, looking back on it now, I would say is probably not the healthiest, because it was when I refer to the fact that my family seemed to fit the incest profile, this is what I mean, that it was sort of my father and me against my mother. He would both literally and figuratively sort of be rolling his eyes at me about her kind of behind her back. So it was very clear from as soon as I could think that my father didn't respect or like my mother very much, and he respected and liked me, especially if I would be a little clone of him, which I became. I took on all of his interests, and, you know, he loved horse racing, and I went to the racetrack with him a lot, and he had been a trumpet player, and I played the trumpet. He was a frustrated writer. I became a writer. So we became a little team.
But perhaps not for the bad, but certainly a connection, as
well,
you're saying.
You know, again, it's not black or white. It's not good or bad. It was a lifesaver for me because I wasn't close to my mother, and it gave me, you know, at a time when girls were being encouraged to have a future that was defined by finding the wealthiest possible guy and getting married to him and, you know, either staying married or getting a lucrative divorce out of the deal, my father was encouraging me to have a career. He was teaching me all kinds of, you know, skills. Just the fact that I was a girl playing the trumpet in 1957 or whatever it was, 59, certainly I was the only girl in my school who played the trumpet. Everyone else was playing these scratchy violins. And, you know, so he imbued in me from a very early age the idea that I could be who I wanted to be. I mean, granted, he would rather I would be him. But at least I didn't have to be, you know, a housewife.
Right. And so it sounds like you got a strong sense of independence out of that and self-identity, it seems.
Well, that's an interesting turn of phrase. Now, I wouldn't say either independence or sense of self. I got a sense of myself as him. That was part of the problem. And I think in a better world, I would have needed some time apart from my father when I became an adult and had kids of my own. And in a better world, I would have gotten it by saying, calling my father and saying, I think I'm a little too identified with you. I think I need a little more independence. I think it would be better for me if I didn't just model myself on you, but I actually gave some thought to who I want to be. And I'm going to need a little space. And my father could have said, okay, well, I'll miss you. Call me when you don't need space anymore. And then, you know, 6 months later, I would have called him and said, I miss you, and now I know who I am, and let's have dinner. But instead, you know, I was very enmeshed with him and very entangled with him and could not get his voice out of my head on every matter. Anytime I tried to make any kinds of decisions, it was always his voice in my head that I heard and not my own.
Was there any rebound involved in that when you slowed to conceptualize the possibility of abuse? Was that sort of a micro, as you say?
Yeah, I mean, you know, especially back in the 80s and 90s, but even now, validly, there's a concept of the incestuous family. It doesn't mean any incest is taking place sexually or physically, but just that there is a dynamic in which the daughter becomes the little wife, and that, I think, was true. And I think there's a whole... there's an analysis or a way of seeing parenting as something that's done to gratify the parents, and there's a way of seeing parenting as something that's done to bring out the full potential of the child, whatever it may be, however likable it is to the parent. And so, you know, the essence of incest is the gratification of the parent at the expense of the child. And I do think that there was a lot of that going on between my father and me. Just don't think it was sexual.
Interesting point. Sort of that balance between wanting to pass on what you know and how you see the world and how you approach life, to be balanced with educating children to go out on their own, sort of that mix of, you know, take a part with me,
right,
because I've done so well in life, that sort of.
Right, and also not just giving your kids what you know or who you are, but also having to take this huge deep breath and step back, and even though they came out of your body, to look at them and say, who are you, with a really fresh mind, and not say, well, I am this, so therefore you are that. That's something that I think is pretty new in parenting in this country.
It seems to be, yes, doesn't it? Even though it seems on the surface that we've said that, it's quite common sense.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that may be sort of that 50s baby boomer fall off.
You don't see that many. You know, it's not Walmart and Sons, is it? You know, there used to be businesses where that were
right.
Generations of kids taking on their father's, or, you know, usually their father's interests and work. So you don't see that very much anymore.
You got involved, and I remember reading in there about the false memory syndrome folks. In fact, you mentioned a woman that I've spoken with as well, Elizabeth Loftus.
Mm-hmm.
Your transition from they are the devil incarnate, I think, is somewhere you said that, or I may have read it,
mm-hmm.
to maybe there's something here.
Well, I can't tell you how ironic it seems to me to have a blurb, an endorsement from Elizabeth Loftus on the back of my book, because she was my number one enemy during those years when I was writing the exposés of incest and when I was believing in recovered memory. And I would go to one trial in particular that I covered for the San Francisco newspaper, a trial of a father whose daughter had accused him of molesting her. And the father turned the tables and was suing the daughter's therapist for having implanted false memories in her mind. And hearing Elizabeth Loftus testifying in the defense of the father, saying as a scientist that recovered memory simply could not exist, did not exist, and all these memories were made up. And I did, I don't know if I said it in the book, but I certainly felt she was the devil, as did many people, which is one reason she had to have bodyguards at a certain point, because she flatly denied that any of these allegations of any of these, you know, children in preschools or adult women like me could possibly be true. And incidentally, even though she loves the book and she and I see eye to eye on a lot of things, I happen to disagree with her that false memory is not possible. So, but again, there you have the nuance. You know, it doesn't have to be that we agree on everything.
Oh, that's true. But certainly, a bit of erudition, a lot of research, a lot of eyewitness things that she's done, and many others have followed in her footsteps and continue to. But in that regard, it it must have been an internal challenge for you to say at some point, what have I done?
Oh, God, yeah. Well, that
when was that epiphany? I shouldn't say epiphany. When was the moment when you thought to yourself, I have a doubt about what I've said?
Well, I always had a doubt, and I tried to make that clear in the book, although, again, you know, people will read the book or, more to the point, not read the book and go on Amazon or, you know, some website where somebody's published an excerpt or whatever and go off on a tear about how, you know, I made this thing up and I didn't know enough to doubt myself and all that. Well, I did doubt myself, and there were several instances over the 8 years that my father and I were estranged after I made the accusation when people would ask me what they should do. For example, my brother and sister-in-law needed to know if they should send their daughter with my father and his wife to Europe for a couple weeks. And obviously, if he had molested me, they shouldn't. So that was one episode that I describe in the book. Another was my father's wife, my stepmother, came to me a couple of years into my accusation and asked me if she should divorce him. And she said she was lying next to him night after night thinking she was married to a pedophile. So in both cases, had I been a person who was 100% convinced that this had happened, I would have said, yes, divorce him, and no, don't let your daughter go to Europe with him and his wife. And in both cases, I had nothing to say. I couldn't say, you know, when his wife asked me that, I sort of fled the scene. You know, I just said, I can't tell you what to do. And then when my brother and sister-in-law asked about their daughter, I said, well, just make sure that, you know, his wife is around and, you know, give her the training that the daughter, their daughter, my niece, the training that is now mandatory in schools where they teach kids to know the difference between good touch and bad touch did not exist before. You know, never was there a time when I said, oh, absolutely, this guy's a pedophile, divorce him and don't let your kids anywhere near him. So it was a gradual process. There was always doubt, but what happened was a combination of things, another perfect storm. In 1996, one factor was that the culture had turned again, that the people who had been sent to prison in the 80s for on the testimony a lot of times of preschool kids who had been brainwashed, in my opinion, or had been at least interviewed in a very unethical way, manipulative way, a lot of those guys were getting out of jail because the judges were going back on appeal and saying, what is this recovered memory thing? What is it with these three-year-olds saying they remember, you know, flying through the air and having orgies in their preschools and stuff? And also cases like the one I just described where accused fathers of adult daughters like me were now countersuing and saying, no, I didn't molest her and I want reparations from the therapists who made her believe this. So there was this external cultural move away from believing that recovered memory could happen. So that was one thing. On the more personal front, my father had a heart attack, and when my brother called to tell me that he had had a heart attack, I immediately started asking my brother where to go to the hospital so I could be with him. And my brother, without saying anything, by not saying anything and by not telling me where my father was in the hospital, I suddenly realized that, of course, nobody would want me at his bedside when he'd had a heart attack. And I realized that he could die before, I mean, any of us could die, but, you know, the fact that he was ill and getting older made me realize that he could die with, you know, still with this accusation still hanging between us. And so that was a huge shock to my system as well.
Kid, you didn't go to therapy for that.
I didn't go to therapy for what?
For the realization when you said, I don't want him to die. I'd hate to think
that
happened.
Oh, I was in therapy this whole time. I mean, I had been in therapy from, I don't know, age 30-something, 31 or 32, to age 45. I was in therapy every week, sometimes multiple forms of therapy. You know, I was in therapy for myself, for incest memories, and I was in therapy with couples therapy, and I was in family therapy, and, you know, I was doing what everybody did in big cities 10 years ago or 15 or 20 years ago, which is, as, you know, you said earlier, something hurts, go to therapy. So.
That's an interesting point about how that, if you will, the guilt or the fault or, you know, that sort of arose. There's been a lot of literature on kids who, mm-hmm. Later on, when they've, you know, one of the topics that's come up and partly on this show we've examined is false allegations. I mean, proven false allegations. This mm-hmm. is false, and that's the way it is. Mm-hmm. And there's a woman named Amy Baker who's written a fascinating book on that called Breaking the Ties That Bind. Having interviewed these adults, you know, oh my gosh, I can't believe that happened. And they've got this upswelling of how did they get swept up into it, guilt, and it takes that comes down to a therapy sometimes as well. Something a while ago I labeled in a conversation with someone as not mass hysteria, but focal hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
You go to the therapist and then they act on this and sort of search for it and becomes investigative and confirmative rather than how's the child doing. And of course mm-hmm. kids tend to, and perhaps it's your experience, kids tend to want to please the therapist or the provider, if you will, health,
mm-hmm.
mental health, because my aunt brought me here. So mm-hmm. this must be a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that
and
desire to please, I think it's corrupted.
Yeah. For the book, I interviewed a couple of now 30-year-olds who were preschoolers and were part of what really was mass hysteria in some of these small towns across the country who, you know, in one case, a girl who's in her early 30s now, and she testified at age 10 against her favorite preschool teacher who was in prison for 27 years, just recently was released. And she realized a couple of years ago in her 30s that she had lived a lie this whole time, not because she purposely lied, but she was hypnotized by a very unscrupulous psychiatrist, as were the other kids who had gone to that preschool, and, you know, was really led through testimony that just simply wasn't true. And, you know, imagine this girl who's the beginning of her life, and she has to live with knowing that she helped send someone she actually loved to prison falsely for, you know, he's now in his 80s and just got out in time basically to die.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, some repercussion to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me. How has that impacted you post deciding and going down the road of saying that was all false? How's it changed your perspective on things in general? You know, how you feel, how you approach things, what's the truth, what do I realize, how do I process things? How does that?
Well, I think what I said earlier, you know, I'm a very opinionated person. I always have been. You know, I was a 60s child, and I, you know, I grew up feeling that anything, you know, starting with the psychiatrist at age 5 or whatever, but continuing on, you know, I was raised in a state or achieved a state very early of complete disbelief and skepticism about everything I was told by everybody, especially adults and especially governments and especially adults in power. And, you know, I dropped out of high school and I was, you know, the war in Vietnam was going on. And if, you know, for those who are young now and hear about weapons of mass destruction and are shocked that, you know, we could launch a war based on a lie like that, boy, we had some really big lies going on in the 60s about the Vietnam War. And, you know, so I grew up just kind of believing that I knew the truth and everybody else was lying. Not everybody else, you know, my compatriots in the anti-war movement or the civil rights movement, we knew the truth. But, you know, there were all these really big lies floating around out there about black people, about what women were capable of, about why people were gay, you know, you name it. And so I became very polarized and have spent most of my life being that way, as we discussed earlier. You know, someone's either good or bad, and something's either true or false, and
right.
My side or your side, and I really have a hard time going there now. It's not to say I can't still be a jerk, because I can, and I am, but I'm not as willing and certainly not as eager as I was all my life to divide everything into one of two categories of right or wrong, and much more likely to see the small picture in the big picture, if you know what I mean.
Right, and that's, and you've been able to integrate that very well, it seems.
Somewhat, yeah. I mean, you know, I don't really want the conclusion of this conversation to be, you know, well, lucky me, I accused my father and ruined my family, and now I get to have this great philosophical, you know, perspective from the top of the mountain or something. I mean, I believe in general that anything that happens is a learning experience, and I think a really joyous, wonderful experience can be a learning experience, and a hideous experience can also teach you things. Personally, I'd rather give and get my lessons from from the joyous experiences. But, you know, of course I learned things from this, and my whole family learned things from this. And at the end of the book, there's a, not to give away the spoiler alert here, but when I started writing the book, I went to every single member of my family and gave them a chance to tell me 20 years later how this had all affected them, and or 10 years later. And my father really surprised me, because he ended up kind of apologizing for the kind of father he had been, and said that he could actually understand how I could have come to that conclusion, or why, at least why I would have been really angry and disappointed with him. And as a result, we have a better relationship than we've ever had, and I do with his wife also. And that is certainly not an outcome I would have predicted, and don't try it at home, folks. I don't recommend it as a way to get there, but you know, it did have some positive results.
I remember from the book there was I was struck by the part where your father called back after you sent him a card. I think it was a card.
Right.
And you described, if I'm not mistaken, flying around the room or floating perhaps.
Right, floating on the ceiling.
I didn't write this down, I'm thinking.
Yeah.
And then you recalled or had a moment where you, the therapist or said to you that was of molestation effect.
Yeah, well, by then I kind of knew it on my own, because I had done all this writing and research, and I had spent a few years sitting in therapy sessions with fathers who admitted to it. Abusing their daughters, and their daughters describing what it was like to be molested by their fathers, and that was a very well-known common symptom of trauma, really, but of sexual abuse in this case, that you kind of leave your body. And a lot of the little girls I would interview or sit in on therapy sessions with would talk about how while their fathers were abusing them, they would be on the ceiling of their bedroom looking down. It was a way of not being in their bodies and kind of distancing themselves from the experience.
Yeah, I think they use the term dissociation in that regard.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I didn't want to get all fancy on you, but yeah.
Oh, no, you know, that's, I'm in the, you know. And some of that can happen. I mean, even in, you know, that's sort of the same thing. Someone comes in, says, I read on that a cough and an ache in my left toe could be, you know, this tropics. Once read an article on, you know, the jungle. Could I have that? You know, no, I don't think so. But once they've got it in, it seems a life of its own. Well, it's not a blurry. So hysteria effect, the system of abuse management, probably the best, seems to have pockets of recovery, and if you've got 8 out of 10 or 8 out of 15, this road. And it seems, at least in some circumstances, folks I've talked to and situations I've been involved in, that misuse, misappropriation by therapy / helping hands, sort of that the road paved with good intention, folks. Meaning to do well, but not winding up in of certainty, yet pursuing it. It's unfortunate because children don't have the skills that you described. Oh, I can rationalize this now. I can say to myself, good, not rationalize, but I can understand this now. So maybe it's a holdover from when I used to think that, but I'm not going to run back and run with my dad now.
Well,
get
you know,
out of here.
I think there are a lot of ways that, you know, when you asked me at the beginning, how could this have happened to me? And, you know, I think while you were talking, I was thinking about how panic works on a very personal, individual level. I have two sons. One was in a lot of trouble when he was a teenager. And so I would, you know, be at home at dinner when he was supposed to be home at 6 o'clock, and, you know, 5 to 6 would come, and I'd notice I was getting kind of shaky, and then it would be 6 o'clock and he wasn't here, and by 6:15 I was sweating, and by 6:30 I was calling, you know, his friends, and, you know, I was not in any kind of rational state during that time until I saw him, until he walked in the door. You would not have wanted to ask me a question about anything and expect to get a reasonable answer. You know, there's the whole body reaction to fear and panic and all that, and it, you know, now we know a lot more than we did then about the biology of the brain and how the brain works. But you know, you can wear grooves in your brain that are laid down by panic, by repeated panic, and that's really what trauma is about. And so, you know, when I think about this crazy person I would become every time my son was late getting home from school, and multiply that, you know, by bazillions, because the New York Times is saying your son is dead or in jail, and the Phil Donahue show is saying your son is dead or in jail, and, you know, it sort of becomes difficult to talk yourself back from that ledge when everyone around you is in the same panic. You know, what people need when they're in a panic situation is accurate information, and, you know, preferably delivered by a calmer person who can help you see another perspective. And there was very little of that calming influence going on at the time.
I'm sorry, I interrupted.
No, that's okay. I was just going to say, yeah, I think in a way. I mean, I also feel that I was an adult, and I was an intelligent person, and I bear personal responsibility for having done this too. You know, I could have believed it and never said anything about it and just dealt with it myself instead of accusing my father when I wasn't completely sure. I could have also, on the other hand, done what a lot of women did, which was sue my father. I could have made it public and, you know, really wreaked even more havoc than I did. So there's a range of things I could have done. I wish that I hadn't done what I did. But, you know, I don't think it's, again, a simple matter of, oh, it was mass hysteria and I got caught up in it and it's not my fault. Nor do I think it was just my fault. I think if what was happening in the culture hadn't been happening, I would have found some other reason to be estranged from my father for whatever period of time I needed to grow up. But I also think I would have found it. So this was a particularly horrible way to do it. But, you know, I don't think it's entirely to be blamed on the external forces. Yeah, the name of the book is not You Lied, it's I Lied. My Lie.
In putting it all together, for other women who might find themselves reading the book or hearing another interview with you elsewhere, who may have struggled with this, some realization, or perhaps, do you have any advice for them?
You mean women like me who realize that what they accuse their fathers or whoever of is false?
Yeah,
well,
right.
There's nothing to do but make it right. You know, you've got to, I mean, it's very scary to contemplate. And when I was going through the process of realizing it wasn't true and then thinking, oh my God, you know, it's like in a way it's such a relief to realize that it wasn't true. And in another way, it was equally horrifying to think, oh, I did all this for nothing, you know, just caused all this grief, and how can I ever look myself in the eye again, or how can my family ever forgive me? But there's really only one way to go, you know. When you've committed wrong, you got to try to make it right, and if you're sincere about it, and if, you know, you can be forgiven by the others, that's great. At worst, you know, I would hope that you could forgive yourself, but that's the hardest part for me. It's been a lot easier for my family to forgive me than for me to forgive myself. On the other hand, I definitely am glad that I, you know, came forward with it. That's the only chance of redemption there is. I feel very lucky to have that form to communicate with, yes.
Well, it was well written, and I certainly enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Anything else that we missed?
Yeah, don't forget to tell them to buy the book.
Oh, of course. Yeah, that's, I've got my last 1 minute segue here. Available on Amazon.com and others.
And my website lie. Is MeredithMarin.com, so they can go there and learn more.
And let me spell this so we've got it right. It's Meredith, MeredithMarin.
Right.
My Lie, A True Story of False Memory. Got a picture of you and your dad on the cover. And certainly an enlightening and encouraging book. Very much something I think, even as someone who's not personally involved with it, can certainly use this book as an excellent guide. And I say guide because that's in a way how I saw it, to what you may find others experiencing and then have at least some connection to it.
Mm-hmm.
An emotional level, like I felt it. I felt it was very much of a inviting people in, inviting me into how you personally felt, which was important.
Thank you very much for saying that.
Meredith, thank you again. Thank you so much for being on Men Matter, and I do hope that this is a great success. I have my copy, so
good.
I'm in. And I hope that the listeners have enjoyed this. I know that many folks were looking forward to it, and I do appreciate your taking the time out of your day. It's, well, if you're down on Pacific Coast there, it's 6 o'clock, so still most of the evening ahead of you.
Plenty of time to get started. Thanks so much.
Meredith, thank you again, and good evening, and best of luck to you.
Thanks. Same to you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye for now. Well, that's been Meredith Marin on Men Matter. We've covered a lot of topics tonight. Please feel free to blog in or email men.matter.show@gmail.com. That's men.matter.show@gmail.com. Thank you for listening in tonight. This is available for download later on, MP3, and tune us in next Friday. We'll have our guest identified during the week. Thank you so much, and good evening.